It's my great pleasure now to welcome Professor David Little to the stage. And David is going to talk on an expert panel presentation on alleviating poverty through aquaculture. How can we improve? And David is a Professor of Aquatic Resource Management at the Institute of Aquaculture, University of Stirling. He has an active program of teaching and research with a focus on tropical aquaculture and is particularly on the impacts of development. His current research projects include coordinating a large-scale collaborative research project on sustaining ethical aquaculture trade, aiming to support the dynamic trade in farm fish and shellfish between Asia and Europe. He's also involved in a consortium promoting decentralised fish seed strategies in Asia, research into sea cucumber and co-culture with shrimp in Thailand, and pagasus production in Vietnam. David continues a long association with AIT in Bangkok through a range of teaching and networking activities. Please welcome David Little.
Thanks, Jeff, and welcome, and thanks for everyone who's staying around. First of all, thanks very much to my panel, several of whom were incredibly active, and this is a very much a team effort. We're picking up where Dr. Gupta left off to some extent. We're side-swerving from what Rahan has just talked about in terms of the focus being the farmer, and we're broadening out again in terms of where poverty and aquaculture interact. And the outline of my presentation is I'm first going to go through a few of the changes in development thinking since the Millennium Meeting. I'm going to consider the natures of aquaculture. We're all talking about aquaculture as if it's somehow as if we're very clear about it. I want to come back and look at that. I'm going to ask what we mean by poverty, by vulnerability and well-being. I'm going to touch on food security. The stage has been set by the excellent presentation first thing this afternoon. And, of course, talk about aquatic food security before then thinking about something about progress, opportunities and drivers. First of all, I think what we see on the big stage in terms of rural development and support for agriculture is there's been a malaise in donor support. As little as 4% of development support has gone to agriculture as a whole, even though 70% of the global poor are in rural areas. The World Development Report in 2008, these take a while to produce, but that almost predicted that something had to change. And that was the first report for a long, long time of the stature that really looks at the whole sector that looked again at development through aquaculture, through agriculture. And they came up with this idea that you could really put countries and contexts into agriculturally dependent, transforming, or urban. And I think, interestingly, you may disagree, but most aquaculture promotion, and indeed most aquaculture in the world, is happening in transforming countries. And what I mean by that is that agriculture contributes less than 25% to overall growth, and yet more than 60% of total poor exist in rural areas. So that's that definition, not narrowly within the aquaculture world, but coming from the bigger picture. What other influences on development thinking? Well, we've had this post-Washington consensus. The Washington consensus that said big business will work, let's have small government. What's happened in the last decade is it shifted back a little bit towards there needing to be a more balanced debate. We've had this huge, of course, elephant in the room of climate change. It's affected a lot about how we think about development. And then towards the end of the decade, the global food shock. Again, many people said this was absolutely inevitable. Private sector development is very much been in the scene, and it's affected the way we think about aquatic resource development, the influential World Bank report changing the face of the waters. And here's something perhaps some of us don't accept, but I think if we look into the broader world of food production, there's been a move away from a default position that there should be and there will be a small farmer first approach. But what is a small farmer? We'll come back to that. Let's think of all, first of all, about revisiting definitions of aquaculture, because it's important. If we're going to start thinking about how we interpret poverty impacts, well, how do we define aquaculture itself? And, of course, there's multiple typologies. Where it is, the type of technology, the type of species, the trophic level of the species. Is it near a town? Is it in the country? Is it traditional or modern, as Professor Peter Edwards would like to categorize and has in the past? scale? Is it large? Is it small? What does it mean? Scale, or perhaps another way of looking at it. Perhaps we should be looking at relations of production and how and in what way people relate to aquaculture and their activity that they're engaged in. Because for sure, we talk about farmers, but do we really mean farmers? Do we mean owners or managers or lessees or labourers or traders? Who are we talking about? Are they full-time? Are they part-time? Do they do it year-round? Is it seasonal? These impact on what will really mean in terms of their relationship with aquaculture and poverty. This has come to a head in recent years with, is a pangasius farmer at the moment small scale? Has a shrimp farmer in Thailand been small scale in the sense that agriculturalists use the term? If you've got a small area of land, you can only intensify up to a certain point with a certain level of resource. But if you've got a small shrimp pond, walking around the coastline of Thailand tells you, you have to be a very rich person to stay in that game at this point by local standards. The same could be said of pangasius. You're not growing pangasius for sale right now unless you're a very resource-rich person in the Mekong Delta. That is not like a poor, small-scale rice farmer. So we must get these terms straight and discard them and move on, if they're no longer useful, to us understanding what they really mean. Another thing is, we've heard this a lot. Rohana said, I think earlier today, the little amount of information. That's part of our problem. We have glimpses and we make big conclusions. What we need are sensible sampling frameworks so we can really see what's going on and adequately sample. And then we can start talking about as if we know something. I'm going to introduce these terms, which were coined by Ben Belton, who's just finished his PhD at my university, quasi-peasant, quasi-capitalist, and capitalist. And these are used in the sociological terms. And this really came out of an FAO workshop in Hanoi, probably a little difficult to read. But really, quasi-peasants are people, sociologically, who don't employ labor. Quasi-capitalists are people who are starting to employ labor to increase and to access and sell more in the market. And capitalists are just more extreme end of that continuum. It'll be in the report if you want to read more detail. What about rural and urban? We again seem to think farming happens in rural areas, but of course there's been a lot of research in the last decade that talks about what is rural, what is urban, and how are they linked together? So this lady in Bung Cheng Ek in Phnom Penh, growing a water spinach, this is a system which is a common pool resource that treats the human waste coming out of Phnom Penh and probably produces an estimated 50% of the green vegetables consumed in that city. Urban system? Well, maybe, but for some of the year, her family live in rural areas. So the household and the livelihood is partly in the country, partly in the city. And this is not unusual. Context specific. Again, Hanoi, growing valuable aquatic vegetables on the outskirts of Hanoi. Growing or just part of the value chain? Are you part of processing, getting a quality product into the city? Are we talking about farmers or are we talking about people here? I think we've got to get off the farm and look around and see what's happening when we talk about poverty. We've got to consider value chains. And as we've seen in the last decade, a huge growth in entrepreneurial aquaculture activity around the region. One of the things that's done that, that's really supported that, is improved seed and feed. And what it does is it just opens up a huge box of opportunities for poorer people, like this guy in a pangasius growing area in Bangladesh that has a livelihood option of moving feed around from the local feed mill to other places, to places where it's being used. I think if we look at evolving forms of aquaculture, the household enterprise remains core, and I think that's an important point. But there's lots of ways people are now actually doing aquaculture. We've heard about common pool resources. Culture-based fisheries, they're often called, but there's lots of ways people are now using open access, as it was called, water bodies. Maybe they've got a lease to use cages. Maybe they're just accessing irrigation tanks to catch fish. They may be stocked, they may not. There's been lots of attempts in the last, not just 10 years, 20 years, going back even further, about how we can more intensively manage these systems. Can we get women's groups? Can we do this? Can we do that? Let's be a little bit critical. How often is it the poor that really benefit? How much so-called elite capture is going on, and yet still, perhaps, benefiting poorer people through employment or somewhere in the value chain? And let's not think that it's all about stocking hatchery seed. Dr. Shakuntula mentioned the small indigenous species. Most people with small ponds and ditches in Asia will be catching more than what they stock. And my experience is they always didn't listen to the advice to pump those ponds and use rotenone. Most of them have always had those in their system. And actually, the system has moved on because they're now often more valuable than the fish they're stocking. Community level type water bodies, can they work? Our experience in Sri Lanka and India suggests smaller, more homogeneous groups work best. We've got to acknowledge they're often multiple use, and that can mean multiple conflicts. If we want to intensify, how are we going to manage sustainable stocking? We should be thinking more about when things don't work, why don't they work? Let's get some lessons learned. One of the operational frameworks we've seen used in the last decade around the world for rural development generally is the so-called livelihoods framework, which I'm sure many of you have seen. I draw your attention to the idea of vulnerability. How does aquaculture and poverty interrelate when it comes to how poor people deal with shocks, how they respond to trends, and what about seasonal impacts? So I'm going to spend a few minutes thinking about that. What do we mean by poverty anyway? The question when someone says it's the very poor, the medium poor, people laughed. I thought it was a very good comment. What is poverty? It's highly contextualized, and it's very much of, you know, the person himself, the person, the household themselves, how they view poverty. I think we're all moving away from simplistic measures of $1 a day. The World Bank themselves talk about the multiple natures of poverty. Economists, other types of social scientists have been moving away from that simplistic notion for a long time. But there's also the dynamic. We think about the poor. The poor are always with us. Well, there's been some very interesting work to show that actually poverty's, people are getting out of it and people are falling into it all the time. And that's perhaps how we should look at it. Maybe we have to think about involvement or exclusion from aquaculture, not necessarily negatively. Perhaps being excluded from aquaculture might actually be a good thing, as I'll try and show you. But what is the evidence for the role in reducing vulnerability on one level, in other words, making poorer people less vulnerable, or actually escaping from poverty? Where are the good cases where people have gone from being poor to no longer being poor? And what about the notion of uncertainty? Because generally, that's something that stunts people's abilities to move on and get out of poverty. Finally, vulnerability, we can look at it at different levels, at a sort of community level, or we can look at it at a household level. But also vulnerability happens within households. There may be people who are particularly vulnerable within them. Hume and Shepherd think about chronic or transitory poor. Krishna went on and talks about stages of progress as a way of looking at people falling into or climbing out of poverty. And one of the outcomes of his research suggests that cumulative ill health often triggers families, households to fall into decline. My question is, have we got any evidence that shows that aquaculture can protect in any way from that happening? That would be very useful. Is there any evidence of intergenerational poverty either being reduced or improved through people having ponds or access to systems over a longer period of time? Okay, that's stopping people going down. What about helping people come up? Well, what Krishna found there was that income diversification was the most potent way. And this is case studies from all over, not aquaculture, but generally about income diversification. He found that, for instance, access to irrigation was also very important, and it was different between marginal and high potential agricultural contexts. But be careful. Investments in irrigation can also be a point, turning point into decline. So when we get that loan to someone to put in the on-farm reservoir he can use as a fish pond, if it doesn't work, it may actually send that household further down. So there's responsibilities here. Some development agencies talk about do no harm. Aquaculture potentially can do harm, and we should remember that. Targeting, that's been part of agricultural development for as long as anyone can remember. And I think coming back to Krishna, he talked about we need to understand the reasons why people fall into or climb out of poverty if we're going to really do anything about it. And what is aquaculture as a means of improving well-being of the poor, or just as a mechanism to support escape? Do we try and target the poorest areas, the poorest locations with the greatest number of the poor? Some interesting work in Vietnam suggests that the biggest number of poorest people on the Red River Delta. But there's probably a good reason, as the Ministry of Agriculture and Rural Development are, targeting the overall smaller number of people, but people with less opportunities in mountain areas. Really, we've got to target our resources very carefully. Do we target the poorest communities or the poorest households within communities for support? Do the poor have access? A study recently carried suggests that, well, the poorest have no land in Bangladesh. 50% of people in rural areas actually have no land. But that doesn't mean to say supporting aquaculture is a bad thing, following the logic I've just given you. If the most marginal farmers, not people, can be supported, is that going to stop them falling into poverty in the future? So they're not poor at the moment, but does aquaculture stop their decline into poverty? Can and in what way does advocacy and support to access water resources help? We've heard about group projects. How well do they work? Where are the numbers? Where is the data? And in the context, even where the poor can access ponds, is this supporting their escape from poverty? And if so, how? So lots more questions. Interventions, we hear about interventions. We did this and we achieved this. I think we do have to question whether targeting this quasi-peasant, the small pond often, the small system, has failed in terms of transforming livelihoods. I think we see a realignment of opinion. There's been a lot of discussion about this over the last decade, but that's one reason it's failed in Africa. We should be supporting small and medium enterprise, as Brummett and co-authors suggested, and much the same has been said by Peter Evers for Asia. If we look at the agricultural story, that's become more or less accepted that more commercial agriculture supports more employment for poor people. And overall, that's a more effective way to reduce poverty. Is it the same for aquaculture? How are the aquaculture involved and benefiting at the moment? Well, the man who gets his daily wage by extracting pituitary glands in a Calcutta fish market, that's how he does it. The lady who is subcontracted to put manure into a nursery pond in the Red River Delta, that's how she does it. None of these people have any land. They're not fish farmers. This employee in a nursery operation, she gets a living wage. These guys in the Philippines, in Pampanga, they're not fish farmers. They're not employed. But they're working in systems owned by very large landowners, and they are scavengers. They are gleaners. But that's how they survive. That's how they live. And there are special roles that are emerging as aquaculture is booming and diversifying. The people under the water in Vietnam are specialized actors in production systems for pangasius. So intensive are those systems. These teams go down and pump the waste out two or three times in a culture cycle. Who'd have thought we were doing that? Who'd have thought they would be a pangasius poo remover 20 years ago? That's what's happening in this dynamic. Growth in the market chain. The markets provide huge livelihood opportunities. For the little boy here in Jessore, being able to clean up in a market means that he can feed his family with a bowl of fish for the day. Or for this widow who sits on the outskirts of the margin, means she can feed her family. Getting off the farm and looking at poverty and well-being in communities around aquaculture is really important. And this work by Bolvig and Stefano Ponti is seminal and very important for aquaculture to understand. And the differences between the vertical aspects of value chains and the horizontal impacts. And broadly, the difference is, you know, here's your farmer and here's your exporter, but there's lots of things happening at each node that are very important for poverty. We must look at how livelihoods then are being impacted at the household or the community or the sub-district level. What are the roles? Are they producers, farmers? Are they intermediaries? Are they consumers? Do they work in a processing factory? Do they sell their neighbor's fish at the side of a road because they have no land? What about poverty and what about resilience? Something that's current, but it's worth taking a look at it. Risk, the likelihood of a specific shock, a flood. How are farmers better off, poorer off dealing with that? Better off people, poorer people. Vulnerability or the sensitivity, such as a price hike, and the resilience, the capacity to deal with that shock. We've heard about this today, that smaller farmers, smaller producers have difficulty, more difficulty than larger. But it's not just farmers, it's poorer people in the value chain that are having the same problem. And how do we deal with it? Well, one of the ways that people have suggested is that we need to enhance people's adaptive management skills. People need to be able to actually adapt to the factors, the reality that's changing around them. The example that Peter Edwards gave of Java, those farmers can't continue in grow out. They've shifted into something else. They've adapted. They are resilient. This capacity of change, we see it around the region. I think we have to be positive about this. There's lots of examples of it. And I think we have to look at, again, lessons learned, how we can share the lessons learned, and how different is it between the better off and poorer in these aquaculture value chains? And how can we support poorer people to be more resilient? How can we build their capacity? This has been going on a long time. There was a project in northwest Bangladesh 15 years ago that was looking at helping fry traders become better fry traders. They were the poorest people in the value chain. They were helped through training and capacity building, etc. There's interesting work going on community-based organizations in different parts of the world. And this idea of producer clubs or aqua clubs as well. We've heard something of those. Let's consider just for a moment, though, that there may be some disbenefits. I almost hate to mention it, but because it's also upbeat in this conference. But I think we do have to reflect that sometimes things don't work. People have variable capacity to deal with change. And the poor generally have less capacity to respond. We've heard a lot about conflicts and in the past environmental impacts, you know, the loss of mangroves and the loss of livelihood opportunities for fishers, etc. And I'm not going to dwell on it, but they're still there. I think overall many of those situations have improved. But sometimes aquaculture really does remain the livelihood of the last resort, where we may have a situation where that's all people have to do, and they have very little power to barter or to really negotiate their way to a better livelihood. There are examples of that that are in the paper. I think we should consider broader and indirect impacts as well. One of the most important in the areas of great dynamism in Asia are these reducing prices for poor consumers. Again, you wouldn't have seen this picture maybe 15 years ago where it was taken because small pangasius and small silver carp wouldn't have been available in the abundance they now are. And, you know, they wouldn't be as cheap. And studies we've done have shown that actually, in many cases, these small, and the whole culture systems have changed to produce smaller fish for poor people, have replaced small indigenous fish. Now, we've heard some of the consequences that may incur, but that's our reality. Well-being, it's not just about cash. It may not be about cash at all. And studies that colleagues of mine have been involved with suggest that motivations for adoption and retention of aquaculture by people who are doing it on a very small scale, are multifactorial. They're about social and nutritional benefits, and they're often to try and support their households in the face of seasonal differences. And this graph shows something about that. We're back to the gleaners in Pampanga. Now, you go to some communities there as a CIRAD-promoted project did, and one of my students did this work. Basically, 50% of those communities don't have a job, how they learn their living is by gleaning in huge commercial systems. And, you know, for some of the year, income levels drop by a huge amount. And the only way people survive is by the social transactions that have been going on through the year. So aquaculture supports a lot of people who are not producers. Food security, we've seen this before. We shouldn't confuse it with food sufficiency or food sovereignty, which are rather different things. And I think the point that Dr. Shakuntila made earlier about this micronutrient insecurity being a real key thing is worth repeating, because ill health that's related not to, you know, real dying hunger, but to malnutrition is been associated with a real vicious cycle, a positive feedback mechanism that stops households actually getting out of poverty, even if they have opportunities, because of these poor physical condition. What else about food security? We heard, again, the issue that all fish are not equal. Small wild fish are really good for us. Slightly larger culture fish may be less good for us. But there are other things. Lipid is generally good for rural people when the overall diet is low in lipid, and farm fish tends to be higher than wild fish. Farm fish often has poorer lipid profiles, and what I mean by that is the omega-3 to omega-6 ratios. Recent research in the last 10 years has shown that. And I think when we talk about micronutrients like calcium, like iron, like the vitamins, we've really got to consider who and how the fish is consumed. Is it the most at-risk groups that are really suffering? We've got to consider the broader diet, and that often hasn't been done. We've got to look at changing risks as well when we shift from wild fish to farm fish, from things like foodborne trematode infections and likely contaminants. And of course, consider that the very ratio of value between farmed and wild fish has changed quite a lot. Promoting aquaculture, improved nutrition. One of the things that Ben Belton has actually questioned is how food insecure are the farming households, because they tend to be better off. And yet the most food insecure households cannot farm themselves. When we looked at poorer households in three sites in Southeast Asia, Jack Morales and a lot of partners from around the region found that the poor were relatively more dependent on aquatic animals that they raised themselves. So there's conflicting evidence here, and it depends where you are. There's definitely a trend towards increased dependence on small farm fish by the very poor. I think we can say that. And I think farmed aquatic animals have definitely become part of coping strategies by both producers and consumers. Lots of other issues to think about with food security. There's lots of methodological issues. We've got to think not just about the fish, but if you've got a pond in a system, then you're perhaps changing other food that's being grown around the system. And that may change nutritional outcomes of the vulnerable within households. So, you know, when older people are left on farms in marginal farming systems, if they've got water on farm, they can grow vegetables. That is an important thing because they're particularly vulnerable. If you can grow enough vegetables to sell because you live in an urban situation, again, you've got cash, you can buy a broader range of food and have a more diversified diet. What are the drivers of change? We've heard about global change, global trade. Well, local trade, I think we can say, is really important. And if there's a big change, it's this urban market pool that's driven aquaculture development along. There's been lots of change in demographics and settlement patterns. And this broader in Asia, particularly where we see the biggest changes, we've had very fast broad growth rates, increases in growth. And we can call that imminent development that's just sort of happened. And aquaculture has benefited from that because the market has been much stronger for the products. We've had what we can call cuisine shifts. As people move into cities, they think about food and they eat food differently. And that's changed market conditions as well, some of which have gone back to rural areas. And there's a burgeoning interregional trade, for instance, within Asia and within Africa in farmed aquatic products. Technology dependence, technology change, where does that fit in? And I was pleased when Amara mentioned this idea of technology can sometimes be quite bad for the poor on one level. There was a very nice case study of that by grouper fisher farmers in southern Thailand a few years ago, where the very lack of grouper hatcheries meant they had a relatively strong case. But if we look generally, yes, adoption of shrimp and carp, particularly hatcheries, has made huge opportunities for poorer people in these broader production and marketing systems. What we see is that the poor have got into niche producer roles, as Peter says, often in the juvenile stages, and they are still often small-scale and seasonal. And there's good evidence for a lot of spontaneous adaptive management here. So Dorr would put it is, should people be hanging in or stepping out? What is the vulnerability of the poor in value chains? And some work done by Locke and Simon Bush and others on the Mekong Delta gives lots of sense of, I think, optimism that if you're pushed out or you step out of Pangasius, there's lots of other things you can do within aquaculture chains, whether it's diversifying off farm or on broader livelihoods or cooperation. Governments, of course, can affect this through policy changes, land tenure, taxes on regulation or regulation and quality of feeds. I think we should be looking at these impacts on poverty in terms of transformative or incremental, and I explain very quickly what I mean. There's lots of different ways that poverty has been impacted, whether it's the single, you know, Regal Springs farm in Honduras, for instance, that's done a lot for those communities, or clusters of small and medium enterprises we see around Asia in the hatchery business. Sometimes it's through domestic, sometimes it's through export. But we've got to be aware of these increasing barriers to the poor in the rise of these private regulatory systems as globalization's affecting. And for sure, larger corporate organizations are advantaged. What about incremental benefits? We think through a study of many, many studies we brought together that quasi-peasant, in which 10% of total high, probably doesn't exceed 10% of household income. But there may be numerous other benefits, particularly in water-limited marginal agricultural systems. Most poor smallholders remain dependent on agriculture, and on-farm water storage can be critical to enhance their broader resilience. And also, a positive thing, there's been an overall decline in the entry costs of doing this sort of thing. Ponds are ever cheaper to excavate, seed is ever more available and cheaper. And I think what we're going to see is a continued coexistence of the quasi-peasant on one hand, subsistence-orientated, local markets and quasi-capitalist. Moving forward, I think we can say that quasi-capitalist is more likely to transform. These are farms, small and medium enterprises, employing people. They're transforming areas. They're transforming opportunities for non-farmers through employment opportunities. And a focus on the rapidly growing urban domestic markets, which tend to be less risky than export markets, is something we should really consider. There's lots of examples of catfish and shrimp, of course, being also transforming. Finally, I think we need a strategic approach of aquaculture to impact on poverty most cost-effectively. There's lots of examples of relative failure and unexpected success based on quite modest investments. Let's find out what paid off and learn from it and try and adapt those things. And we should be targeting adaptive capacity, supporting poorer people who at the moment depend on aquaculture, wherever they are in the value chain. There are vacant niches there, whether it's rain-fed systems, which are common pool resources, still underutilized. There are lots of opportunities there. I'd like to acknowledge all the inputs from the panel members who contributed inputs and source materials. Thank you.
Thank you very much, David. And I'd like to congratulate you on probably raising more questions than you answered, changing our thinking, and generally sort of presiding in an excellent overview. Could I have all the panel members to please come up?
Hi. I guess that's a question that was covered to some degree in the last panel. I tried to make some notes as you're asking. Just some quick reflections. I think from our experience working with Pangasius, Vietnamese farmers on Pangasius, and I know there's been some work on this in Thailand as well, and that's one of capacity, and capacity of any farm, not only small farmers, but medium or however we want to classify them, just in terms of keeping records. It sounds very simple, but even with the most simple HACCP-based standards, the degree of reporting that is required is difficult. And actually, I heard some people, trout farmers in Europe, also complaining about this as well. So that's one issue, I think, when it comes to certification. That's one issue. On the specific standards, the finding that we have from Pangasius is that extremely important for the standards to be recognised by the market. We are on the verge of having ASC, the Aquaculture Stewardship Council. Some farmers around the world, Pangasius and shrimp, tilapia, are exposed now to global GAP certification already. And we see reports that say there are 70-odd other certifications around. The global GAP is recognised by the market. ASC will be recognised by the market. HACCP, which is a food safety standard, essentially, is recognised by the market. But you also have this other category. There's SQF 1000, which we used, and also the BMPs, which is also being trialled in various countries. And they're not currently recognised by the market. And that means that it's very difficult for processing companies to give a premium for those standards. So that's an important sort of barrier, I think, at least in trying to determine what standards are more appropriate for smaller farmers. And I'm saying that word with some trepidation after Dave's presentation. Maybe I'll leave it there.
I think maybe just to add from the previous panel, wherein we heard a lot about this EMPEDA working with the NACA farmers in India, I think there again the small farmers are clustered together. I think it's the organizational support that's playing a key role to provide this kind of support to the farmers, at least in the initial stage. And in the agriculture sector, and I'm aware that in India, the government provides large part of the cost to be met in terms of certification. So it's the question of getting the government involved at the right time to make sure that this initial support is provided and the farmers are being given that kind of...
One thing I think we do need is a lot more understanding of how these groups work and when they work, what were the factors that supported them. When they don't work, why not? We just hear success stories, and I think that's a problem.
In addition to the support of the government to certification, there are also some moves from the commercial side wherein they are working with the processing plant to be the main applicant of the certification. So what happened is that the processing plant is working with several producers, small-scale producers, and encouraging them to follow a certain standard, and the cost will be shouldered by the processing plant because they need to have a certified farms to support the demand from their market.
Let's take a nuke.
Yeah, I just compliments the previous speaker. That's in regard to the certification of the respective countries. What I observe actually, these kind of things should be certified also the just competent authority.
Yeah, I think there's one issue that was not really discussed. That has something to do in the sustainability of helping, especially the small scale. This is the issue on property rights. You know. Most of the aquaculture is really done in open access areas. Something is a common property resource. Okay. If we want to help them, we have to do some empowering, meaning we have to provide them with some preferential rights or territorial use rights in fisheries for them to do aquaculture in order to solve the problem of ownership as well as long-term security. It would be very difficult for them to undergo a lot of training, a lot of investment. In the long term, they will not be able to, they have no assurance that they can make use of that particular resource in the long term.
Yes, just to add to your point, in some places you can have also the opposite side, that is the aquaculture that permits to ensure the ownership of the land. Like for example, I've been working in Ivory Coast, and there the legal status was the land belongs to the one who is valorizing it. And many people were building ponds because it was a way of ensuring the property of the land.
So much are present on the day-to-day activities with these small-scale farmers. Surely, I can agree with you, as you said, aquaculture can do harm, and it can actually bring the poverty line rather down. So are we to motivate that kind of operation? I am actually glad that you brought up this presentation for the main reason that all the other presenters, basically we're talking about small farmers in groups that are actually making a living through some cash of income coming. But how can we motivate? Your topic said alleviating poverty through aquaculture, how can we improve? I would say, how can we motivate those small-scale farmers that are operating in such a case that I indicated before, the case of Namibia? Seasonal, water availability, all those. Because to me, it is hindering actually our practice of aquaculture in our country at the current stage. Thank you.
Thank you for your question. And I haven't got a definitive answer because I've never been to Namibia. And I think, you know, there are lots of examples from around the world of how people use aquatic systems and how they benefit from them. We've got to be realistic what changes they can make, particularly if they are poor or if they're vulnerable in some way. I think we've got to set the expectations bar at the right point. Is it going to transform their livelihood if they have a small muddy pond, even if they can get some fertilizer and a few seed? Unlikely. I think the broad answer to that is unlikely. It may help them in lots of other ways in a small way, and it may mean that they don't fall even further into poverty. But we must be careful about what our expectations are and be realistic and really ground our ideas by working very closely with the people we're trying to work with.
Yes, we've really got to look at the total picture. You actually said they're only part-time farmers, so that means they already have a job somewhere else. So the issue is to what extent they are going to put effort into aquaculture, as you indicate. So is aquaculture going to be a realistic way of making money? If they're staying on the farm as a base, then they could just use the facility to produce a little bit of fish, maybe for domestic consumption. But the issue is if aquaculture is going to make a significant contribution to their livelihood, then it's going to have to be improved, and that's going to mean off-farm resources. Now, the person has got to decide, is that the best option in terms of their access to resources, or should they do something else, or should they leave the farm altogether and go into the capital city and do something else? So it's not just aquaculture. They could hang in with aquaculture, they could use aquaculture to step up, or they could step out and just drop aquaculture. And a lot of small-scale farmers are doing that. That's why the cities are burgeoning. And the industries also, and service, and it's needed.
I might just quickly add to that as well. I think what Dave's presentation really drew out is that it's about aquatic resources in general. It's not only aquaculture, it's a landscape, especially if you work in Southeast Asia, it's a landscape of aquatic resources. And I think it's important what sort of labels we put on aquaculture. Aquaculture as a poverty alleviating activity may be suitable in some circumstances, but I think what the presentation also brings out is that simply labelling aquaculture as the only poverty-alleviating activity within a broad range of aquatic resources can be damaging, because the poor people are often more dependent on non-aquaculture-related aquatic resources. And that's, I think, a very important point to make.
Okay, let's go for another question. Ram, you had one, and then we'll come to you next. Sir.
I'm Ram from Asian Institute of Technology. I think poor means it's a relative term, and I have a problem with this $1 a day as a benchmark. I think in Latin America maybe something different, and even within Asia, Thailand condition is different, I mean, income level. And if you use this $1 a day as a benchmark, then you know it will be really difficult for the project. Many projects have difficulties. How many people have been alleviated? Poverty alleviation, reporting is really a problem. And also, if you look at the UN definition now, they have actually increased to $2 a day. So goalpost has moved further another one kilometer away. So I think, can this committee recommend, let's say, country-specific label benchmark so that country-specific projects can say, okay, this many people have been assisted to come out of the poverty line. Thank you.
Some response?
I mean, a point I was trying to make was that it wasn't a very sensible measure of poverty or well-being, and that everyone's moved away from only using that really as an indicator. So, your point.
Yeah.
And there has been a lot of World Bank initiated, I believe, is Dr. Imtiaz here, poverty alleviation strategies in which each country has decided what poverty is in relation to their own particular circumstances. So it's very, very context specific.
Okay. Yes, and yes, just to add, maybe this is an illustration of the gap that exists between the need to give a simple explanation of what is poverty, whereas, as it was shown, the poverty is, in fact, is a very complex concept that is within a very complex human system, a very complex interaction with the resource, with the livelihood options, and maybe that could be the time to shift to some new indicators that have the conditions to assess this global complexity.
Yeah, I'm Atunda from Nigeria. I want to share my experience as an African country with Namibia. Nigeria used to be in that situation. I don't know what is limiting the production of fish in Namibia, whether it's lack of water availability or the basic input like the seed, the fingerlings, whether they still collect from the wild. If it's free from the wild, it will be seasonal, but that can be, you know, solved by development of hatchery, not sophisticated hatcheries as such, but even cottage hatcheries that can make sure that the fingerlings will be available throughout the year. So, because if it is depending on wild collection of the seed, then definitely the production will be limited, but that can be solved by development of hatcheries for sophisticated things. Nigeria used to be in that situation until about 10, 15 years ago. Now, almost everybody in Nigeria produces fish throughout the year because there is ready availability of fingerlings and the feed, not necessarily expensive. Because, you know, on-farm produce feed from local ingredients, and this can gradually come up, and you can get across this problem of seasonal production and seasonal operations, and actually if many rural farmers are living exclusively on aquaculture production in Nigeria today, and they produce throughout the year, I know that thing is also possible in Namibia, but it depends on water availability or whatever other factors that are limiting their production. Thank you.
I mean, in Nigeria, of course, it's the most densely populated and highest population in sub-Saharan Africa. So there's a huge demand for fish. And as you said, you've developed African catfish culture, and hatcheries have been developed. Pelleted feed has now been produced locally as well as being imported. And fish is fetching a good price. And so all the ingredients are there in the mix, as it were, for aquaculture to be profitable. So my first question, if I went to Namibia, would be, what is the demand for the fish? In other words, could it be an economically viable activity? I mean, that's the first question, and you work backwards from that.
Costa Fierce from the University of Rhode Island. So thank you, Professor Little, and the panel for an extremely in-depth, insightful, thought-provoking, and I think very provocative presentation. And I say provocative because I'm rewinding to 20 years ago, and Peter mentioned this, to what he called the aquaculture production networks in West Java in the reservoirs that sort of had knock-on effects throughout the entire region of West Java. And I think it's a little bit generous to call them such a sophisticated name, as almost like they were planned. What actually happened is a new grow-out system that was technologically feasible, and mass markets were available. And when these systems developed and zoomed from 0 tons to 50,000 tons within a span of 3 to 5 years, what happened was, and really the result of that was quite a brilliant group of Indonesian academics as connected to farmers who knew the farming situation. And we were just privileged to be there and observe what the knock-on effect of this grow-out system was. So that kind of has haunted me for many, many years, because what happened was in the next sort of 5 years after that, there were massive seed shortages and farmers couldn't get seed. So here we were as an international development project, and we were looking at the lack of, the planning had only really occurred for a grow-out system. And really had the, it had no idea that there was going to be this massive regional aquaculture development, and then where the poor actually were going to be located. So if you look at our World Bank report, yes, just like you've just seen, David, what a wonderful listing, you know, of new jobs that were created. So my question to the panel is number one, shouldn't we be planning a little bit better for these aquaculture production networks, you know, where and forecast a little bit more about how the hatcheries and the nurseries of many different sizes and grow-out systems fit together. Number two is, shouldn't we be planning for, you know, really who we are benefiting? So maybe we should be giving bicycles to the poor to deliver feed, or we should be looking at some other interventions, because clearly the intervention we were involved in really only thought about displaced, hundreds of thousands of displaced Indonesians managing grow-out enterprises on the surface of water bodies.
Yeah, Barry, I'm well familiar with your work, the cages in the in West Java. But remember, there's been traditional aquaculture in West Java for decades, and possibly more than 100 years. And there were seed production networks and grow out before those reservoirs were even built. And most of the grow out was in small ponds, just as most of the seed production was in small ponds. It was mainly common carp initially, and then tilapia mozambica came in, as you call it, and then Oreochromis niloticus. But what happened, you're right, as the cages developed, that became a major moneymaker for grow out. And those nurseries, the seed production, expanded. They already existed, a lot of them, and they expanded. A lot of the seed production was in rice fields. That's more or less disappeared now, and it's in rice fields converted into ponds. But it was there, okay, as a private sector activity. It was not developed by the Department of Fisheries. It was developed by the farmers.
Thank you for your observation about the reservoir in Indonesia. My name is Fatur Rizukadi from Indonesia. thanks to ASIAR and also NACA, now we understand that there is eutrophication because of the waste of the feed from the aquaculture. And then, but now, like this presentation from Dr. Little, that adaptive management is important. Now, after we make a study, what kind of the new livelihood that can support? I think the CBF, culture-based fisheries, is very important. So we try to stock with the make fish fry, and this also established the network with the hatcheries in Bali, to getting the hatcheries from Bali, and then increase the catch, not only tilapia or common carp, but also mixed fish. And the good thing is the taste of the mixed fish raised in the fresh water. That's very soft stone, you see, bone and so on. I think that's the new information about the management of the reservoir. I think thanks again to the ASIAR and NACA.
But these reservoirs are in big trouble, as you're well aware. The Saguling was the first one, and that's collapsed more or less. There's no common carp or tilapia raised in Saguling. Chirata, I was there last year. It's like a pea soup. Yes, NACA induced project has stocked milkfish, and it's helping a little bit. But there's still a gross overfeeding overall of nutrients into the lake. And those milkfish are not going to remove them. Same as just walked in, you're not going to get back to an almost pristine reservoir. I'm afraid if it continues with the same level of feeding, you're going to get an overturn and the whole thing's going to collapse, as it has done in the past a couple of years ago.
I think it's time to... I've been getting the cut notice from our... from our director. So I think we'll close it today. Let me please join with me to thank Professor Little and the panel. And I'd like to thank the audience too for contributing to the discussions. Thank you very much.